This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You ready?
I'm ready.
You seem particularly charged up today.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about this. I miss you.
I miss you too. We haven't recorded in a while.
Yeah.
Wait, let's save the real emotions for on mic.
The marvelousness is Maisel Goyce. The marvelousness is Maisel Goyce.
Two friends Maisel
hanging out at work. We are two friends who hang out only at work.
Friends, work, friends, work, friends. Outside of work, no, thanks.
Call me friends, Maisel, friends.
Call Maisel, coffee pot, break room,
Maisel,
our friends outside of
meetings.
We've hung out lots of
times. Have to respect each other's boundaries. Marvelousness is Maisel Goyce.
My name is Mr. Maisel. I was a song hero.
Mr.
Maisel showed up.
All right. I have to because he hasn't been introduced yet.
You shushed a guest.
I always shush a guest.
You do. Well, you were shushing sweet Carrie Rosen.
Poor sweet Carrie Rosen.
And she was saying, Alice, I really liked your take. So you're like, shut up for a second.
You haven't been introduced.
You were legit mean to
and
her.
And I'm somebody who cares a lot about decorum. So that's
Alice.
Why.
Yeah, you're all about manners. That's my memory of you. Welcome to the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel Goyce. I'm Kevin.
And I'm Alice.
And we're the Maisel Goyce. Hey, we introduced ourselves. The Maisel Goyce. Hey, this is our first episode we've recorded in like 2 weeks.
I know.
Something,
we're
right?
Almost caught up.
We're almost caught up. We were ahead, and then as happens every season, we're now caught up and struggling to keep ahead and our head above water.
But we had a good few relaxing months there, and that's thanks to you and your planning to bank the episodes.
I really appreciate that. So this didn't feel like a grind, so it felt like a fun
zero
thing that
grind.
We get to do.
It was like...
That's a Kevin T. Porter promise, is zero grinding.
Zero
yeah.
Grind.
I think that's
not a coffee man.
You.
Yeah, not a coffee man and not a kafifi man either. I don't like that president.
Guys.
Oh boy. Folks.
Folks.
There's some Maisel news to catch up on. A little Twitter sniping and whatnot we can talk about, which I actually think plays into the themes of this episode pretty well.
Yeah.
Did you at all read the thing that I sent you?
No, I just read the Twitter Q&A.
Okay.
Before I watched the episode, so that I was like, I better watch the episode because I don't understand what any of these questions are.
Yeah.
Our guest wants to jump in so bad.
And I want our guest to jump in real bad, so I'm going to introduce him right now.
He keeps almost saying things.
Oh, he's been a good man.
If you were really silent once the episode starts, I'll be mad. I'm gonna be mad anyway.
Well, let me introduce him, ladies and gentlemen. You may have seen him on Search Party or most recently on Russian Doll. He's a stand-up, he's a comedian, and you can check out his album, Okay, on Spotify and iTunes everywhere. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Yadoye Travis.
Hello, how are you, my good friends?
Hey, man.
You did such a good job introducing the album.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I wanted to, I didn't want a who's on first situation. I wanted to frame it as quotation marks.
More people say it like that than you think.
Like, Yodoye's album, Okay, like, just...
Oh, no, I've had multiple people be like, Okay, and I'm like, I didn't tell you to say it like that.
Yeah.
What's your preferred pronunciation of the album?
Okay.
Okay. Just, like, tentative, like, almost like a dismissal, Okay.
Okay.
I really like telling people I have an album and just telling them it's okay.
It's okay. No, that's perfect for it. Yodoye, I listened to the whole album before we recorded
today.
Why
did you do that?
Because he's thorough.
Because I wanted to get to know you, and I think the album's so funny and so good. I'm so delighted to have you on the show.
He's very talented.
Today.
Thank you so much.
He's
Kevin
extremely talented.
That's
not talking about Yodoye.
What?
Oh boy. Yodoye.
I like calling it like this, like, okay. Which is the April Luke's daughter pronunciation of it.
Now, Yodoye, did you know that you're 2 degrees separated from today's episode of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
In what sense do you mean that? I had no idea.
Well, you know the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, like
right.
This person knows this person.
Yes.
So if you do this with TV and film, Yudoye Travis mm-hmm. was in the television show Russian Doll.
I was.
Which was had an episode directed by Jamie Babbitt,
uh-huh.
who directed this episode of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
So well, you were almost. Okay, go ahead.
I was not in the episode.
You were not in that episode. I do realize that. But you were part of the production.
I was part of the show. It's
degrees of separation rules. It works.
I'm very pedantic in a way that makes things not fun.
Shallow and pedantic. Well, thanks.
I just got your text.
It's okay. Well, thanks so much for joining us
on
the
show
today.
Of course, thank
you for having me. So this has become like a fulcrum debate of the show, mm-hmm. especially with a lot of the stand-up guests that we've had on the show.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about the way the show handles stand-up comedy?
I think, and I'm sure people have said this so many times,
mm-hmm.
either on or off the show, the fact that she's doing so well after like a month of comedy mm-hmm. infuriates me.
Right.
It makes me so mad because it doesn't make me that bad. But like, but just the notion of like, I think just for the narrative, it's very hard to balance the whole, the fact that comedy is hard for women, but then also by the end of the season, it's just like, it seems like it's amazing for
everyone.
Wait,
have you gotten all the way to the end of the season, sir?
Oh, I'm just saying by the end of the first season.
Oh, sure,
like,
sure, sure. Yeah.
It just seems
sir?
Like, sir.
I want to be proper.
Pardon me, sir.
I want to show respect.
Before you go on. No, what we're doing is watching each episode. So we've only watched the episode we had you recap, uh-huh. and we haven't finished.
We have not watched 208, 209, or 210.
If you can try to avoid spoilers. Yeah.
I have not watched that
Okay,
part,
cool.
So we're
all
okay,
the same.
Oh, my God, amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the only person that's going to spoil it is Francisco here.
I have some hot takes on the finale.
He might not even be breathing.
We have a little puppy dog in the studio.
Just quick shout out to eyebrow dogs in general. I'm just such a big fan.
This is something, you know, there's an NPR critic and writer, a great man named Glenn Weldon, who wrote a nice critique mm-hmm. of season two of Maisel in particular. And he talks about how it's like, oh, she should lose more. That was his big takeaway from
it.
And especially as it gets into like the later half of the season, she should be losing more.
Yeah.
And I guess he, you know, and I haven't finished the season, so I guess he's talking about professionally. I guess there's like some personal losses.
Yeah.
I guess in the divorce or not divorce with her husband. But yeah, I think for comedians and for people that do this professionally, for us, it does become like it's definitely movie magic, and we have to grant the same magic that allows Jackson Maine to arrange, fully remember the lyrics, and know Shallow by the time Allie shows up the next night.
Yes.
It's the same like time compression movie magic that we must apply
for
this to make sense.
I'm sick of having to do all that heavy lifting as an audience member.
You just want to
tired of being so hardcore. I want... You know what I mean? Because, like, and the other thing I was thinking about that is that with Maisel, like, with Midge, like, she said,
I say Midge? Just such a perfect comedian lady name.
It's true.
Midge. It's like, hey, Midge, how you doing?
It's
Midge.
True. And I am offended by that. So we'll talk about that later. But,
because you would wish he had said Alice instead.
We'll talk about it off mic.
Okay.
But the way that Midge is losing interest, or maybe the show itself is losing interest in stand-up, it's like, so would I if I was that good at it right away.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
if I bombed once in like a year of doing comedy,
you'd be like, why does anybody do this?
Yeah, like, what's the point of this?
It would feel like selling insurance in the Midwest. It's like, well, I guess anyone can do
exactly.
this.
Exactly.
Well, that's also like a time period where
we just lost half our listenership.
Yeah, I feel like if you're that good at comedy in the 50s, you'd be like, I could sell insurance, man.
Yeah.
I could really go places.
I gotta get out of this awful town.
Yeah.
Well, for you, like, even for your own career, how long do you think it took, even years-wise, till you had a set as good as one of the many sets that Mitch has?
Probably, like, 9 years.
Yeah.
And I've been doing stand-up for 7, so...
So we're 2 years away from the good set.
When you open for me, it's that good. Because, well, okay, not every time, but that's because we've had some really...
Do you open
You've had to do some heavy lifting.
Yeah.
Do you open for Alice? Is this true?
Yeah, but I'm not running... If I was doing the rooms I want to be doing, which is like 50% people who came out to see Alice Wetterland, mm-hmm. Doya would have better sets because he wouldn't have to contend with like weird Boston racists sure. in the audience.
Oh yeah, that happened.
Like it'll be a good show, and then he'll just like be like, wait, I can't not address this. It's like yeah. everybody's now thinking about what you just said, sir. Yeah, so that's true. But like you've had those sets, and it is like. But it is few and far between where you're just, I mean, Midge, I've had sets where it's like, I'm, you know, everything you say, it's like, ah, that's like how it works at Comedy Works or something like that
yeah.
in Denver. But like, it's also like, I got so excited in the first season because I thought we were going to be dealing with seeing somebody really working on becoming better at stand-up and having those sets that were like, remember how yeah. that set that she had that was like good but not great and she was kind of frustrated? Uh-huh. I was like, yes, no one ever talks about that.
Can I make a wild comparison that's kind of a self-suck too?
Yeah.
So I think that desire and that desire that a lot of the viewership had
yeah.
for what it was going to be like after season one and some of season two as well is like, oh, this is the comedy show. This is when we get into the nitty-gritty of like, okay, yeah, you need to hone this bit. What does it mean? What's the timing? What's the rhythm? Blah, mm-hmm. blah, blah. What's this kind of room look like versus this kind of room look like? What's cardio versus yeah. a club versus whatever? I think this reminds me of expectations that people had for Gilmore Guys. So when I started Gilmore Guys, wow. I wanted to start a comedy podcast where we talked about Gilmore Girls, but that in that order. I wanted to start a comedy podcast
yeah.
okay. in which we talked about Gilmore Girls. I was like, oh, that'll be a fun format, and that's like a fun thing to appeal to, yeah. and there's something almost kind of like gimmicky or kitschy about that premise. And then what happened over time is people checked it out, obviously, because it's like, oh, this is about Gilmore Girls. And then it strayed away from being like solely about, okay, what's Lorelai doing in this scene? And then the episodes got longer and longer. A lot of the listenership dropped off mm-hmm. because, I mean, some people stayed and then it grew in some ways, but a lot of those initial people dropped off because they're like, wait, I thought this was a Gilmore Girls show. And for us, it was like, well, no, it's kind of a comedy show.
Yeah.
And that's what
yeah.
we want to do. And that was always like a tension. Okay. I think was a good right. engine for the show because it was a legit tension in like the audience expectations versus what we were trying to do with it. But yeah. I feel like that might be part of what's happening here.
So you think Maisel. You should have failed more on Gilmore Guys?
I should. Well, we failed a whole lot. I don't know if you've listened to Gilmore Guys, sir. A little good amount of failure on
one
it.
One of your failures is that you did not hook in Yodoya Travis as a listener.
That's true. The and major I didn't get you as a guest earlier
well,
on.
Well, that is mostly the part of Gilmore Girls.
True.
Yeah, but so in the same way, I wonder if Palladino is using comedy as a format
yeah.
for storytelling about women's autonomy, 50 stuff. Comedy as a genre of a thing rather than a subject of a thing.
Yeah, which I think is interesting for one. And I feel like I have a habit of pointing out these things. I did it on your on Treks in the City when I was on. But like, I thought it was very funny and not funny. That's the wrong word. But like, just weird in the first season when it is very much about women's liberation and comedy, and I just, first of all, cannot imagine someone in my first month of doing comedy just, like, pushing someone off the stage for me. But that scene when, like, she pushes the black woman off
the
stage.
It is a black woman, yeah.
I was just like...
So strange.
It just...
And watching it in, like, yeah... Because a lot of us white viewers, I think, are watching with our eyes wider open now, like, and seeing things that we maybe wouldn't have seen. To see, like, it's so clear that that was a mistake and something that yeah. was not thought about at all. Like,
yeah.
Just like, because it's super, it like rings all the alarm bells.
Yeah.
And you're like, why? That could have been anybody. There was a guy playing a banjo 5 seconds ago, and I thought it was funny that, you know, that's what I said in the first season. It was like, why not kick the guy with the weird pan flute off? Like, right. why did it have to be?
Optically,
yeah,
it felt like a.
Optically, right.
Yeah. It's a thing that's like, not even like so directly bad. It's just a thing where you're like, oh, you're not.
It's messy.
You're not yeah. thinking about it.
It's messy.
And, yeah. And it's just like...
Get your shit together, kind of, I think.
This is yeah. one of thousands of epiphanies we must have in watching these shows where we realize Amy doesn't yeah. care.
Amy doesn't care.
Amy doesn't
it's
care.
A lot of Amy doesn't care. It's the end of the period
this is
on the
beginning
sentence.
And end I mean, of the thought.
That, that moment was very, I wear top hats to the Emmys energy.
It's true. Yeah.
The Babadook of Lower East Side.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. And also, so with Midge, and it is like, if you're going to use stand-up as a format to talk about women's place and their liberation,
or family
or
stuff,
whatever,
or whatever is the story.
I don't know, like, because in the discussion online about the parenting thing, Rachel brought up Don Draper and like how he was singularly, he was a parent, but also totally obsessed with his ambition.
Yeah. Oh, let me give context for that. So,
well, let me just say this before because it doesn't, it's not going to completely relate, but I just think like it more relates to the stand-up discussion. Like, I'm interested in watching a hero of a story like have a thing that they care about that's their thing, that's their journey, like I'm interested in watching that. I'm interested in watching whatever Frodo figure out how to get the ring to Mordor, and they're it's the, about the friends they
and
make
then go to the
way.
Gaslight Cafe afterwards and crush it.
I'm interested in whatever, like whoever the person is in the main character of the story, what they have to have a motivation and a thing that they've discovered that they're going to. It's like normal storytelling. And with this show, and a lot of maybe Amy Sherman Palladino's shows, it's like they've dropped it. Like the thing that we came to see, which was this person discovering their need to do this thing, has now not, it's no longer important. Where Don Draper, his whole thing was like, you know, communication, right? And like, how to translate these ideas he was having, and like, you know, how that his idea of ad making was like exploding all the time in his brain. And it was like watching that was interesting to me, I thought. Mm-hmm. And seeing that main character have like avoid his past by like selling lies to the American people or whatever, you know, like that's the interesting thing about Mad Men. And so the interesting thing about Maisel is like this interesting story of this person suddenly making their personal life public and being a woman while at it in the 50s in a time that's very patriarchal. That's gone. It's like, because it was never hard.
I don't think it's gone though. I think it's still playing in it. It's just playing in it. Here's another thing that I think affects our perspective of it is going week to week. This happens with everything. Going week to week on a show rather than bingey is you love the things you love more, you hate the things you hate more.
Yeah,
if you'd watched season two in one seating, then the kind of like the Catskills nonsense or whatever that you might things you might chalk up to like, this is just kind of shenanigans, would kind of sting less or prick in your brain a little bit less because you'd be on to the next episode. And it's not dropped, I don't think, from the show. Even at the end of this, the whole thing is like, I want to be great. I want to be the biggest thing there is. I want to be the Alice Wetterlin of 1959.
Well, good luck.
Is what she, what she says.
Yeah, but then it's like, why? Do you think
maybe it's like why her trying to make up for the amount of, for like the lack of pacing in the first season where there's just like so much time just killing it at stand-up where she had to like balance it out a little bit?
Maybe, but then like,
but I don't
instead
know what
of replacing it with other shit, why not just replacing it with like doing poorly at stand-up?
You gotta live a life. You gotta live your life.
Because she cares more about family stuff than stand-up stuff. That's just the show.
Yeah, I don't like it.
We don't have to do this podcast.
All right, contextualize the parenting stuff.
Okay, so the context for the parenting stuff is Rachel Brosnahan and Alex Borstein on Twitter did things that I advise no Emmy winners to ever do, which is that they responded to negative comments on a forum not well set up for it.
Oh, no.
So it's funny because this gets into, and we'll start talking about the episode.
You have to stop doing
specific.
That when you're an Emmy winner specifically.
I think anytime it's like you're successful enough to have won an Emmy, that's your license and privilege to log off. And not deal with the shenanigans.
Oh, I'm gonna be so online if I ever win an Emmy.
You're
gonna be like Roseanne Barr, but the other way.
I feel like I've been really successful in responding to Twitter comments. Like at some, I feel like for some reason, maybe it's because I am a stand-up. Like that's the place where I fucking kill it the most. Like I love responding to Twitter comments.
I'm
so good at it.
It feels good for the person doing it, but the optics. Talking about optics, I think the optics of it are always like. It always feels like punching down, as we'll see.
Yeah, but I feel like me responding to Silicon Valley questions on Twitter has been the best place for me to do it. Because it's like succinct, But I guess that's my personal journey as opposed to like the show.
Yes, and that feels different than what they did.
Yeah.
You weren't saying like, hey, you know, viewer in Wisconsin, F you. It wasn't
I didn't also have to have like, let's take a nuanced view of it. That's not really,
So, okay, real quick. The beef kind of starts off with Richard Schiff, Toby Ziegler from The West Wing, former co-star of Rachel Brosnahan on a show called Manhattan on WGN. So he watched it.
Oh, two shows about Manhattan. That seems like a
interesting. It's almost as if, well, we'll give it that
too many.
Too many. So he was like, yeah, it's the best thing on TV, blah, blah, blah. And then a woman online responded to it, and she said, entertaining show. However, I'm in the middle of season two, and I'm wondering what the point was in the writers deciding Midge should have two kids, which is like,
that's
fair, right? Because she's not putting a value judgment on it, right? And then she goes and says, you saw them for 2 seconds when they arrived at the Catskills, and that's it. They're an afterthought. She has no interest in being a parent, so why have her be one? It makes her less likable. Would have been more interesting to have them later in the story, maybe. So then Alex Borstein quotes that.
Yeah.
Miss Susie Meyerson on the show, she says, being likable is for tweets. Women are complex creatures. We got a lot of work to do in a short amount of time on Earth. Now go write your book. Because this woman's bio is like,
I love it.
She says, dreams of writing the great American political history book.
I love her so much.
So Borstein's dunking on her.
That's a killer.
But
I can love it.
That's mean.
Go
though.
Write your book. Sick.
Okay, so
I don't know. I love it.
It feels a little mean.
Who cares?
I think it's mean.
I don't know.
Women can never be mean.
No, I'm not. No. Obviously,
mean,
they can.
So
well,
good
we both
at it.
Pointed
it. Everyone loves it. When I'm mean.
Okay, and then, okay, so
the woman
responds, I have a career and a child. My child is an afterthought. Where were her obstacles at the Catskills? There was a 24-hour nanny there. The kids were not in one family scene after they almost forgot the baby in the car. It's weird.
It's
so, all this is like, this is stuff we've talked about, Alice.
To this woman, I will say, where were these questions in season one? The kids are in season one.
Oh, she's just getting in the mix now, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
The kids were an afterthought for you for a whole season.
Fair.
What are you doing?
Yeah, and this. So then Brosnahan, Emmy winner Rachel Brosnahan from The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
I've heard of her. Where?
So this like this spirals into this whole like back and forth conversation. And the kind of overriding MO is like, this is a sexist conversation. There's been a lot of anti-heroes and like, kind of like flawed people and protagonists on TV where their parenthood is not one of their like big vices. And the fact that you would call out Midge for that being like a shortcoming of hers is sexist. It's like a different sort of expectation. So one woman wrote, I agree and I get, you know, I get the show's style, blah, 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 what they're trying to convey, but it doesn't change the fact that as a viewer, we can't sit to the TV lover, but she's a terrible mom. And Brosnahan responds, absolutely. I'm not even sure I would go as far as terrible. However, she's certainly not winning Parent of the Year, but it doesn't change the fact that this was not one of the primary criticisms of Don Draper or Walter White, who were similarly single-mindedly ambitious.
I mean, that's valid.
She clapped back.
Back.
That's what the headlines were that made this a moment on Twitter. Like,
so
Brosnahan
annoying.
Claps back at blah, 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 blah. And then she goes back and forth. And, like, she's very, she's not quite as acidic as Borstein is.
Fuck.
She's a little more.
Yes, I love Borstein.
People are like, yeah, you know, she goes on to say she's spending time with her children off camera, but her life as her mother is not her primary focus.
Mm-hmm.
And talking about Breaking Bad, she said, that was a drama, and this is a comedy. Midge isn't evil, but sometimes she's blinded by her own privilege and can be self-involved when it comes to pursuing her new dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes on for a couple more tweets. But anyway, I just thought it was a very interesting conversation that tied into a lot of what we've talked about on this show, and also the content of this episode in particular, about the cost of being great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a... I think there's sexist elements to the criticism.
Well, her having kids is like a big plot point, and like it's a big reason why her getting a divorce is a problem. Like if she didn't have the kids, then what's the problem? What's the problem with him leaving? And also, to the sexism of it, Goku. I'm a big Dragon Ball Z fan. Goku is one of the greatest heroes of all time.
I was waiting for Goku to come up on this show. Yeah,
Goku is one of the worst fathers of all time.
Uh-huh.
He dies in front of his own son several times and just leaves him to fight.
That's a bad dad move.
Yeah, it's a bad dad move. Mm. It's a bad dad move. to like prop yourself up as the strongest in the universe,
yeah,
and then just die of heart disease once.
The nerve.
The nerve. And to just let some alien who we've all accepted as Black Piccolo, just father your own child, and that doesn't come up until it hasn't been like a problem for people until like very recently.
Yeah.
I wish I knew more about that, because now I don't have that as a context for my argument, which is that bringing the discussion of whether or not it's a sexist conversation is not equivalent to bringing a gun to a knife fight. It's like bringing a flashlight to a dark room.
I think it's a matter of bringing like 500 followers to like a million.
True.
I think that's what it is.
It's like we all live under this light, right? And so the light of sexism touches everything, and it touches the conversation that we're having. So when somebody says, like, this is a sexist conversation, maybe it sounds like saying, like, well, we're not trying to say that the conversation shouldn't happen. But what we should be trying to talk about is how it is impossible to have this conversation in a decontextualized setting. This isn't happening in a vacuum.
Yeah, that's
the reality
fair.
Is that we're not looking at this woman with the same lens that we'd be looking at a man with. So let's try as best we can to shine a light on that while we talk about this. Now, is fucking Amy Sherman Palladino going to do this perfectly? Absolutely not. Is she going to handle it as an afterthought? Yeah. It's not going to be well done or perfectly done in any way. It's going to probably be a huge mess. But that said, Midge cares about her kids, I think. And she loves her kids, I think. And the kids are not the subject of the story. And I think that's okay. And I think it's alarming to people because we're not used to seeing women have children and have their children not be the forefront of their life. You know, like with Carrie Matheson in Homeland, you know, once she had a kid, it was like everything is about keeping the kid. And is a kid going to be, you know, fine. That's probably pretty realistic for that drama. But it would be a different show if it was like, oh, yeah, the kid, you know, like it's just like we'd be like, that's a monster. And we don't say that about men who have kids and treat them as an afterthought. They can decide suddenly when the kid's 14, like, wow, I really need to connect with this kid. And they're like, yeah, he's doing his best. You know, like we do that, but we don't do that with women. And that's maybe for better or for worse, just the lens we all are using.
It's valid.
That's fair. Counterpoint.
My favorite thing is when at the end of when I talk, there's just this wonderful gap. At the end. What I aim for is to have just a silent moment.
Well, sometimes you can't tell if it's the end of a sentence or a paragraph. Mm, and if there's another sense to come, so you want to give space.
You're right about that.
Yeah. I think your impulse as a person is to want to build on that, and I think it's a problem usually when
with
that
me?
No, in general, when people want to build on things that are finished.
Oh my God, you're right.
You sometimes
also,
yes and
that
isn't
that is
helpful.
That is a finish.
Also with me though, and you know me, and so yes,
I know you,
and
but also
correct.
That was a finished thought.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, I thought it was just a really interesting example, and all parts of the conversation are valid, but it was an interesting example of like how 21st media interacts with an audience, where it's like, it would be wild to imagine Lauren Graham getting on Twitter and being like, actually, you know, Rory and Laura, like defending
what's that forum that you guys used to read
Television
from?
Without Pity, get on TWAP. Yeah.
Get on TWAP.
What is that?
Yeah, Television Without Pity was this
it was
discussion
like
forum back in the day where like people who are fans of certain shows would come together and talk about like episode specific discussion and go back. It's kind of basically what we're doing right now, but in text form.
Right.
And a lot of smart and interesting people came out of there. Great writers came out of there. Pam Ribbon, who co-wrote the new Wreck-It Ralph movie, came out of there.
Okay.
And it's bizarre to think of like Palladino stuff interacting
yes,
in this
is.
Sense.
When and it, for us as a people talking about it, like what a weird situation that we can have literal audience responses and then cast responses at the same time to have be fodder for our discussion. That's just a weird thing.
Totally.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't like it.
Brosnahan, okay. I think ultimately
Doye is a no on that.
Doye, that's a no for me, dog.
It's a hard no.
Brosnahan, I think, was pretty magnanimous in her responses. If you go back and read them, she's like pretty fair. She's like, she's not evil. She's flawed. Like, it's all part of the story. And I think it gets to what you're saying too about like, it's hard to have a conversation without context in this.
Well, it's impossible. And that's all I'm saying is, like, let's never pretend that it's happening.
Yeah. I mean, just a side note.
Oh, sure.
I think I'm forgetting what my thought was. But cool. I just feel like as comedians, if we're going to suspend our disbelief for her amount of success in the first season, yeah. I feel like we can do it
exactly.
for the amount like that she's like
exactly.
time she's spending.
That
with those
doesn't
kids.
Bother me. What bothers me as a watcher of the show is how fucking hard she's killing with garbage material.
Yeah,
that's what bothers. That's the just.
I mean, it was the first.
Really...
It was the first material.
Yes, like... I also think some to a certain extent. This is why Palladino picked this era, because this was the one era where people like talk all the time about growing up in the 50s and being like, all this helicopter parenting. Oh, when I was a kid, I would just run out the door and then kind of come home at some point. Like
the
kids
values
would
align.
Run away and you wouldn't even notice yeah. in yeah. the 50s, you yeah. know? So I think it is also an era in which like we can't judge it from the lens of today's parenting. Mm-hmm. We would never, we would see the kids would be like attached at the hip all the time. Yeah. People bring their kids to work now.
Yeah.
Do y'all want to get into the episode?
Let's get into the episode.
Cool. This is episode 207. Look, she made a hat. Of course, a reference to...
The hat that she made.
Sunday in the Park with George.
Right.
The hat, colon, the hat she made.
I don't...
It's the full name of the...
I don't... What's Sunday in the Park with George?
Sunday in the Park with George is
it's a play?
It's a Stephen Sondheim musical from the 80s. Mandy Patinkin, a la Homeland, was the star of it.
And Saul.
I believe... Oh, that very attractive lady that still looks as good at 70 as she does when she was 30. What's her name? Bernadette Peters.
Mm. Oh, I would have never
that was my
guessed
second
that
guess.
At all.
Yeah. Slay Queen. So it's a reference to that. You guys have never seen that? I've never seen a stage production of it. But it has to do a lot with he's a painter. It's the guy who painted the painting of all the people in the park looking at at the
Surreal.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah. And it has to do with like the cost of art, blah, blah, blah. So it's like the perfect kind of title for this episode. Uh-huh. Right. Written by Amy Sherman Palladino, directed by Jamie Babbitt, Doye's best friend from
My
Russian
good
Doll.
Friend, Jamie.
Jamie Babbitt, a
hey,
returning...
Jamie, how you doing?
She directed like 18 episodes of Gilmore Girls.
Mm.
She came back for this.
Awesome.
And that's by all cool. accounts, like I have some friends that know her a little bit professionally and they just say she's a badass and she takes no shit and she just gets things done and Amy likes that. And that's why it's the rare person who has returned from Amy's best to continue
She can
working.
Contend with Amy.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like, that she can hold her own. And the Amazon Prime synopsis for this is Benjamin opens Midge's eyes to the New York art scene, and she ends up knowing more about art than she realizes. The Maisel and Weissman families come together for a tension-filmed Yom Kippur on the anniversary of Joel and Midge's separation. Meanwhile, a reluctant Susie turns to her family for help in advancing her career. Didn't know Susie was ever going to have a family.
Yeah.
That's a nice little spice.
Yeah.
And now it's time for a little segment we do every episode of the podcast. It's called...
12 o'clock rock, we're going to pop around the culture tonight.
The culture.
The culture. it's every pop culture reference in the episode in a supercut. 207, look, she made a hat, pop goes the culture.
His face is covered
or
in chocolate.
He looks like Al Jolson.
You get it.
You get it.
That's Byron.
Same fucking thing.
That's Franz Kline.
Mark Houdini.
Jane Jacobs.
The last thing I read that made any sense to me at all, Peanuts.
A thing of such beauty that when Jackson Pollock saw it, he said he wasn't sure if he would ever paint again.
Holy, that's Robert Motherwell.
Robert Motherwell.
He stole a Rauschenberg from me last month.
Bring me that last one. Nice ladder. You know what I'm talking about.
I have no idea.
Okay. Did you catch this, Alice?
Yeah.
At the end of the... You could not be less interested in this podcast
I just got
right now.
A heartfelt message from a family member. I'm sorry, and it distracted me. I'll text it right to you. I'm so sorry.
The last part of the teaser...
We'll finish it on our own. Let's,
we'll take it.
Let's round it out.
Alice can
take
a break.
I gotta take this. Hello?
you see an Asian woman with very long hair eating an apple, looking at a ladder in the art gallery. Who is this, you ask? It's Yoko Ono.
Oh, wow.
So it's a reference to Yoko Ono, which is wild. Because apparently she had a little art installation thing where you had to get on a ladder to look at a painting. So the Palladinos put that in as a little Easter egg of like, this is where she got the idea for it. Which is like one of the more cute pop culture. Because to me, Yoko Ono, like all these people were dealing with Jane Jacobs, Lenny Bruce.
Right.
It's like so much from like a history book. And she's still alive and doing stuff. And, you know, a part of culture in some ways.
And it's remarkable. I mean, also, but like Yoko Ono doesn't come out of like a entertain, you know, she's not like old Hollywood. Like, she has like this, not a lot of people know about the history of conceptual and performance art mm-hmm. in the way that they know about Lenny Bruce.
Or, totally, yeah.
You know, like early stand up. So it's, it I think that's the other reason.
Fun.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem but as it fun. Is. It's definitely not as popular.
She was a fantastic and influential contemporary and postmodern performance artist.
See, when you tell
until
me
until the Beatles came along and ruined her career.
They broke up Yoko Ono
from the band mm-hmm. she started with her art and herself.
Yeah, and the and audiences across the world.
See, I'm gonna have to do a little more reading on this because mm-hmm. when you tell me some, you have to get on a ladder to see a piece of art. It tells me it's probably not that good. It tells me the ladder's doing a lot of the heavy lifting.
Yeah,
here.
Literally.
I'm just like yeah,
literally.
Whoa. Yeah, I'll just assume it's good and walk. Past the
ladder. Not get on the ladder.
The first time I saw this episode, I was like, no, shut up.
Really?
Don't do this. And the second time, I was like, this is kind of charming.
It's charming.
It's
I like
charming.
It.
Yeah.
The episode or that reference?
It's like
that reference because yeah. it's so borderline.
Well,
right?
It also it's yeah. borderline in a way where it's not like you see like somebody standing by a river screaming in Germany. You know, it's
right.
like,
yeah.
it's not like hitting you in the head. It's like you have to see it. Maybe it's just a weird thing. And it's just a lady doing a weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of gloss over it and it's part of the scenery or it's a reference.
Or
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It could be, it yeah. wavers. So I like that kind of a thing where it can sit in the background and
yes,
be its own thing.
I did not notice. So.
Easter egg is what it
For
is.
Sure. Yeah. And speaking of children and how Midge views them, she does make reference to them in the art gallery, so she's thinking about them.
How much?
For this one?
Yeah.
$1,200.
You're kidding. I gotta get Ethan a paint set.
So he can be
just
rich.
Think about putting him to work.
Yeah. Yeah, making money off her kids. So it's
that's
a part
a very,
of her process.
It's a very 50s way of looking at your kids. So
yeah.
I think
agree.
She's very much
agree.
How can they
on
make
the same
most
page.
Money?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This episode overall, I really loved.
You loved it?
I liked it.
I'm excited about how much I hate
parts of it.
The Benjamin character now. God, oh. I'm like the only reason I was ever interested in Benjamin was that he did not like Midge. And now that he's fully on board, I'm like, ugh, I hate Benjamin.
Yeah. Well, they've cranked the gear into full Max Medeznuts mode, where it's like, this is just a
it's
nothing
Max
burger.
It's Max Medeznuts.
Yeah. But the Max Medeznuts archetype is a vanilla ice cream cone that you know is there just as a placeholder, because obviously it's going to melt in the sun, and the true dessert is going to come along
right.
later.
He's
so
like,
at this point,
soggy waffle cone.
Benjamin is just filling time.
He's
yeah,
like
right?
Mitch.
Okay,
he's
good.
Like the create a character on Tony Hawk before you do anything to it.
That was my
I
second
felt like
thought.
Somebody on Twitter said that he was the, that guy was the Chris, like he's the Luke and then Joel is the Christopher and I'm like,
He's no Luke.
No, he's no Luke.
He's only Luke in the sense if he was grumpy, but it was like for 15 seconds.
I hate him.
Yeah.
So over like him. And his dumb art thing that he likes.
Like that actor is just the guy I always think is John Krasinski and then it's not.
Poor man's John Krasinski.
Like Zachary Levi is almost Krasinski.
Yeah.
yeah.
Edward James almost Krasinski.
Yeah.
I call him non-Krasinski.
Krasinstant coffee.
How do you feel about Joel generally on this show, Doye? What's your hot take?
About Joel Maisel?
Joel Maisel, JM.
I don't know. He's just kind of a little pathetic to me.
Sad little dog. You don't think he's a hot snack? A la our co-host?
He's
a hot snack.
I've never said anything of the sort.
You have multiple times
Alice.
Petitioned for him to take his shirt off on this show.
Alice.
To come on this podcast and to take his shirt off on it.
Alice. He looks like he's been in a wind tunnel full of grease. Alice.
That's true.
That's the grease lightning tunnel.
He has
he walks
been
there
in the tunnel.
Morning.
Yeah, well, he has to commute.
I mean,
the
just
tunnel.
Like not even a side part. A side part never crossed your mind?
It's kind of, yeah. So, but he's a bit of a butterface, maybe, in that sense.
Alice, we can't talk about people this way. It's dehumanizing and degrading.
And
right,
to that, I will say it looks like he ran his face through a wind tunnel full of butter.
Perfect. He has butter on his face. That's what I mean. What does butterface mean?
He has butter
mean?
On his
he's
face.
A bit of a butter tunneler, if you ask me.
This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Now, unlike anything I've ever talked about on the air, I actually stand by Squarespace. I actually do because I've used it for everything I've made. Literally, GilmoreGuysShow.com, the very website for this very podcast, was made using Squarespace. How beautiful is that? KevinTPorter.com, I made that using Squarespace. My old bake shop website, that was made using Squarespace. Because you can do it all with Squarespace. You can sell content on your website. So exclusive stuff behind a paywall. You can sell memberships, courses, or sell files your customers can download, like PDFs, music, or eBooks. You can do that with Squarespace. You can do analytics with Squarespace, so you can figure out who's visiting your website and why, and figure out how to get traffic and where's it coming from. You can also have people do flexible payments on Squarespace. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. Accept credit cards, PayPal, Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. How nice is that? You can also do email campaigns, so there's constant outreach for your stuff and people know where to find you. So I'm going to let you know where to find Squarespace. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/GilmoreGuys. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now let's talk about your social battery. Maybe right now it's bursting at the seams with energy. Maybe it's a little drained. Maybe you're one of those people like my friend with their phone battery that keeps it 2% all the time, even when they stay home all day. And they definitely could charge up if they wanted to, but they don't. Well, regardless of where it is, it's important to understand why it is the way it is. Why is the battery low when it gets low? Is it because you're feeling less social? Is it because you're feeling sad? Is it because of emotions you've yet to identify? Or maybe just boundaries you haven't set for yourself yet? Either way, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves too thin, especially with social gatherings picking up after the winter. What's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, maybe you don't. Maybe you need a little more alone time. Well, either way, therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. This is so important because I've been in therapy for 10 plus years, for some would say, technically, 11 years this month, and it's helped me so much understand where I get my energy from, how I use my energy, how to better use my energy, and how to maintain things in a way that's sustainable and healthy and good. And that's to do, of course, with boundaries, but also just understanding who I am and what I want. And I couldn't have done so much of that work without therapy. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GilmoreGuys today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GilmoreGuys.
Can we talk about, you know, on this show and on past Paladino shows?
Are you drunk?
Yeah. Fast Talking Brunettes, FTPs, are just Paladino proxies. It's basically, this is who she is, and she's channeling her thing in this person.
Yeah.
This particular white lady. Sure. Yeah. But also, I felt like in this episode, Joel, at least cadence-wise, was starting to sound like Amy, because I've just listened to, at this point, thousands of hours of Amy Sherman Palladino interviews, and there's certain rhythms that he had going when he was like toasting everyone at the party that sounded the way that Amy does in interviews.
We bought it, we own it, it will absolutely kill us, the interest is criminal, I anticipate dropping dead right on this spot.
Wow.
I
own
this
spot. Right?
I get to.
Yeah. That sounds like his, her acceptance speech for the, the Golden Globe.
Yeah.
Does.
Yeah, I did feel like I caught a very brief glimpse of like growth in him, but not in a tangible way, but just in the way he was talking.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, this we talked about in the last episode. They are kind of, and we don't need to explain every Gilmore adjacent term, but they're kind of redeeming him.
Yeah.
In this season. And
no, please explain that.
There's a character named, actually, you know what? This will tie in because there's a character named Dean in season one of Gilmore Girls. Then they introduced another character, and for contrast, they made Dean a little bit dumber. So there was something of a contrast to the two characters.
Yeah, so it was two Rory love interests, and the first was Dean, and Dean was awesome, and he read books, and he was so cool, and like, he was like everything that you want your high school boyfriend to be. And then they brought in another guy who was like more bookish,
and like was kind of a rebel, but then so they made Dean the jock.
Stupid.
Even though Dean was never the jock, it was like Dean wore a leather jacket the first time.
He wore a leather jacket. So when you Dean a character, that's when you make him stupider. Over time.
Yeah.
So then it's like there's more of a different dynamic.
The deaning.
But then what they've done with Joel is they've done the opposite. They've redeemed him.
Undeaned.
So, yeah. Yeah, they've undeaned him. So not only is he smarter,
they've
but he's
deemed
like,
him to be not the dean.
That's right. He's taking care of business. He's buying buildings. It's going to kill them. The interest rate. Right? And he's crushing with women, which makes all the sense in the world to Alice. He's crushing so hard.
Well, in the 50s, too.
I mean, that seems
you're
like
a young
it would be
man.
Rare. Pretty easy to do in the 50s.
Yeah, because if you're a bachelor in the 50s and you own a building, and you know what I mean? Like suddenly you're this huge business mogul and you're like around 30 and you've got a fucking washboard abs.
Yeah.
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 You're going to mop the floor.
That one girl he rescheduled
you're gonna
with.
You're going to mow the lawn, if you know what I mean.
Oh, you're making me and Doye very uncomfortable right now.
No.
I love it.
No, I am fine with that.
You're making me very uncomfortable right now. Ms. Moskowitz essentially is his pimp.
If you're going to be that available, you should consider putting a doorbell on your blouse.
What's she getting at?
I don't know. I also don't know what she means, m'lady.
Where it's like ding dong, like, can I come in? I guess.
Okay,
maybe
see,
you
in context, can I come in
home.
Seems very...
Oh, come on.
I am not a fan.
Now you're making me very uncomfortable here.
Maybe Ms. Moskowitz needs to rehearse her like comebacks and her little scathing remarks a little bit more.
The camera follows her down to her car and she's like, I didn't nail that.
Yes.
I gotta do better next time.
Oh my God.
She's like adding shags.
And then we watch the Ms. Moskowitz show.
The marvelous Mrs. Moskowitz.
Mrs. Moskowitz.
Hey, whoa. That's a sketch they should have done on SNL.
Should build a whole marvelous cinematic
SNL
universe.
SNL can handle it.
Oh yeah, well it's already kind of the marvelous cinematic universe, know what I'm saying?
Hello.
Hi. Mitch talks about Me Too on her walk home with Benjamin from the art gallery.
Trust me, I know how to handle drunk, handsy guys. There's no part of this body that hasn't been groped or poked or pinched or patted.
Lovely.
Oh, yeah. Last week, this club owner kept dropping his pen. He'd crawl around on the ground looking for it. Somehow, every time, he found it right underneath my skirt.
That is a fantastic story.
You learn how to deal with it. Keep your thighs locked, keep your arms crossed. A well-timed what's that never fails to defuse an incoming pass. Chewing is a big lifesaver. Plus, the real secret that all those pervs don't know about, girdles. In a girdle, you can't feel a damn thing. These guys might as well be groping a parking meter. So even if one does get through, how the hell would I know it?
Okay. I feel much better now.
Great.
And then he looks at the camera. I don't know, Dwight.
I actually thought that was really interesting about girdles.
Well, I didn't know that to be the case.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah.
But it makes sense.
Well, that's why you like, started wearing one since you watched this
They're hard.
Oh, yeah.
Girdles. And so, yeah, if people are touching you, probably sometimes you're not even aware. You know, it's not like they're getting through. You know what I mean? Like, they're not making it.
Yeah.
It's different. It's like armor, in a sense.
And then I guess they go in and she has sex with the second man ever in her life.
Yeah, they implied that she went in. I wanted to see the hallway with the bench in it really bad.
Same. It was spectacular.
I thought that was weird because she has a very big home.
Like what? Yeah. How does she not have a hallway?
Yeah, but she don't like, want Zelda up in it. She doesn't
That felt to me like it was less a like, I've never seen a place this big before, and more of just like a design choice.
Yeah, exactly.
It seemed like
I think it was like a design choice. Like he's like, it's interesting to have a hallway with a bench in it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to see what that was.
Yeah. I know this is a point we've made on the show a lot before, but the way they shoot exteriors and like period 1959 New York City on the street, and especially at night, is just really rich and beautiful. And even like that take where they're talking to each other and kind of doing the back and forth and the cat and mouse thing in front of his house, it was like a little painting.
Do you ever find that like in movies and shows that are set in that time period, you only ever see them leaving a building and getting in a cab and being in a different building?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've never seen them like really take a journey outside.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, walk down the street.
Well,
they do in...
I know they do, but like I've never... Like if when I think of a show in the 50s, I think of you walking out of a big theater with a marquee out front and you get in a cab and then you're at home.
Mad Men was like comical in that sense. It would just be like super tight close-up so they didn't have to set dress anything else.
Yeah.
But this one, you do see a little bit more. Like I remember that big... booming shotgun through the garment district.
So cool.
Yeah, in the second episode.
And then, of course, somebody murders your family, and then you begin to fight crime at night, but that's a different thing.
That's part of the marvelous cinematic universe that we're going to get to later, yeah. So speaking of Joel and Dean, there's something in here that might... Joel and Dean. It might qualify as a Palladino-ism.
Oh, Jesus.
It might a little bit.
1 year.
It's him at the end of the party. He's had a lot to drink. He's talking to Archie.
Mistake. Big fucking mistake.
Just go to sleep.
It's my anniversary. 1 year since I just want to be forgiven. Can I be forgiven? I want to be forgiven.
Are you? Yeah.
The Palladino-ism might be when a certain ex gets drunk, they start telling the truth to an unwitting male accomplice.
Luke has done that, I think.
Cut back to Dean on the night of his bachelor party going, pretty hair, and Luke's tucking him in the night before he marries Lindsay.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that? So it's kind of, you know, it's not quiet, but it's there, like that kind of archetype of...
I see, and I just am going to argue that that's just a thing that happens in shows. I don't think that's a Palladino-ism. I think people get drunk and speak the truth. I mean,
it's pretty common.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you're here. But I loved that. I'll say this about Michael Zeegan. I loved that scene. I thought he was amazing. Some people don't do well with the drunk acting, and I thought he was awesome.
Because he seemed like cognizant. It seems like he could walk down the street and pass if he wanted to.
Yeah.
But obviously it was like, he stumbled.
But there was
a
beautifully paced, I don't know, he just did it really. I thought he did that scene justice.
Moskowitz and Archie were very sweet with him.
Speaking of drunk acting, how did you think, what was the artist's name? I forget.
Oh, right.
Declan.
Declan. How did you think that compared to his drunk acting?
Oh, between Joel and Declan?
Yeah.
Well, I guess they're trying to do different things with those two characters.
Very much so, but like...
I guess from a story perspective, I would take maybe like 2 minutes off of that first Declan scene where he's just like ranting and raving at the bar. So yeah, Midge and Benjamin Medeznut's doctor go to a bar where they see a bunch of artists, they see Jane Jacobs, and then they see... I looked it up a couple of times, but it is a fictional painter, Declan Howe, the most famous unknown artist, is how he was described on the show. And yeah, he kind of rants and raves, and then Benjamin wants to buy a painting from him, and so Midge kind of like,
right.
And I feel like that really rang true for me, like the woman kind of doing the man's bidding and trying to like make the transaction happen and all that stuff.
Yeah,
it's pretty well drawn, show. But yeah, it was. Super broad.
Yeah.
Super... I liked it. I don't know. I thought it was good. I didn't have a problem with it.
He's a good looking fellow. He has very high cheekbones.
Yeah, he does.
Rufus Sewell. So they go and Midge buys what essentially Benjamin calls a basic bitch painting at that first art show that they're at.
He does.
But that's what catches... I love this story. I think the story is really good. That's what catches his eye, Declan's eye. And I think that's why he invites them back to his place in the first place. And he says, whoops, why did you buy that painting? And she says,
I walked in that sad little room in the back, the one nobody seemed to care about. And everywhere I looked, there was color and life, something the front room was a little short of. And then suddenly she caught my eye and I thought, I know her. She has a secret. She knows a joke that I don't. I thought, maybe if I take her home, she'll tell me the joke. And that made me smile.
If I was in high school theater still, I would have 100% made this my monologue for auditions.
I think so for sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. Super high school theater-y.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's why I didn't like it very much.
No,
I'm sorry. I didn't love this because it's... I don't know. Like, I come from an art background, so when she said, it's just pretty...
I come from an art background.
It's pretty obvious that...
Your monocle's getting in the way of your microphone.
Oh, sorry. Let me adjust.
Is this reset? Take that again.
Color, it was lacking in the front room. No, it wasn't. It was super bright and colorful. Every painting that was there was just splashed with, like, bright colors. You know what I'm saying?
I think it was more about the room than the paintings, though, right?
like the room was lacking color.
Yeah.
But there was the same
was
color
just, like,
on the walls.
Not fun.
And
I don't
know. She saw color. Yeah. To me, this gets back to the way that Abe saw Susie as a woman, the way Midge sees Susie as a woman. And it's her and Declan's like sharing that you see something in this and you understand a similar right. thing that I understand. So we're speaking like a similar language that makes me trust you.
I will say I'm very glad that they didn't show the painting.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it was the suitcase in Pulp Fiction. It was it
great.
It was incredibly well done.
Yeah.
Because they would have fucked it up no matter what. Because
there's no painting that's that good.
Exactly. You could never live up. Like, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen.
Yeah. Have that's you such seen a... Maxwell Parrish? Sorry, no, that's going to be a dumb art joke for
sure. No.
You do make some art references on here that go even over my head.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I'm great.
That's the conclusion
that's
of
the
that
conclusion
thought.
Of that. Yeah.
You're fine.
You're doing
I'm great.
We're all doing our best.
Doye is always around to kick me back down a notch, and that's what I need.
Do you feel like you keep her humble for real?
I try to.
Yeah.
I try.
He tries. I mean, it's an uphill battle.
Yeah, no, I've been fighting it for the better part of 2 years.
I'm a confident person.
Mm-hmm. Confidence.
Well, I'm also bigger than you, so it balances out.
So Declan trusts her. He shows her the aforementioned infamous painting. That's the most beautiful thing in the world, blah, blah, blah. And they have this like really long, beautiful scene. It's a 3.5 minute shot, unbroken. If one of them screwed up one of the lines, but it's like an unbroken, beautiful thing, especially for a show, for an episode that's not directed by Amy or Dan. It's just like supremely well done. I loved every part of this. And I know a lot of the themes are kind of surfacey and on the nose. And I know there's like kind of a false dichotomy with like you have to give up something. But I thought a lot of it was beautiful. I'll just play a second of it.
You want to do something great. You want to take something as far as it'll go. You can't have everything. You lose family, sense of home. But then, look at what exists.
You don't like this.
No, I actually just wanted to make a farting noise.
It was such a good farted. Scene. I wasn't looking up.
I thought it was great. I thought it was just awesome.
I loved it.
I loved it. I thought it was great.
Because I don't even think that
it was
the...
good.
What's that?
I also thought it was good.
Oh, okay. Good.
We're in agreement.
We're in a trio.
Hey! Unanimous consensus on the Maisel Goyes podcast.
Great.
Now, this
good
is...
Good to be on the same page.
Like, and this is something that I actually don't think is true in life. What he's saying. Like, I don't agree with his premise of like...
Yeah.
You have to give up everything and you can't have it all. And,
that's such a comedy trope, though.
Yeah.
It's
it's
like you have to be depressed to be really good. You have to go through some shit to be...
Yeah.
You could just be smart and know how to write and know how to perform and use your time well.
Right. No, I was going to say that. Time management. If Declan Howell had read like Getting Things Done and had like a productivity app on his iPhone, he'd be like... It's going to be hot and you'll have to wake up really early. But yeah, you can have it all. If what exists.
Yeah, maybe don't go to bars and quote Jabberwocky or whatever.
But
I would say it's because he's he has like deep issues and dysfunctions and an inability to be vulnerable in his personal life. And he's using the fact that he's good at art as an excuse. He's like, oh, well, I can't live a life because I got to be here with this painting, so sorry. And it's like, no, actually, you just haven't worked on your issues.
And I think this is where the proxy of it all comes in.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Amy and Dan have done these shows together, worked together constantly side by side. And it's so interesting to hear them talk about other writers in interviews where they're like, we work with each other because, listen, at the end of the day, I know he has my agenda best at heart. You can't really trust anyone else. So even other writers and collaborators they're hiring, they have like a fundamental mistrust of. But all that to say, this feels like a very personal story of working something out where it's like, maybe this is the way my family looks like and maybe this is what I've chosen. But look, you have the marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And isn't that enough?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, and you see real life rebukes of that, right? Like you see people like Shonda Rhimes and other people are like, yeah, I got family. I got, you know, whatever kind of life I want to. And I can manage this and this and this and this. But for Amy, it feels like this is the cost of it.
Yeah.
And maybe maybe certain people and certain personality types, like maybe even my own personality type, when I think about it, is like, maybe it is like an all or nothing proposition for certain things. But I think there's like, there's a lot of beauty in acknowledging that cost.
Right.
Yeah.
I also think that it bothers me that essentially what we need to do, because we're so intolerant of lifestyle choices that don't conform to our nuclear idea of what winning is in our society and what the dream is, that we have to make art making the excuse, the one viable excuse for not having that cookie cutter life.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like, actually, maybe it's like, you look at a Tracee Ellis Ross, somebody who's like wonderful and a creative and has an amazing career, but also isn't entirely dedicated to her art in the sense that she can't have a family. She just doesn't have a nuclear family because she doesn't, and that's not what she wants. And she's very, very open about that and saying like, look, I really love my life. Why can't anybody believe me? I love my life, you know? Mm-hmm. Because we don't accept that. We have to have, everybody has to have, you know? And like, maybe Amy and Dan can just have their life and not have kids and it's fucking fine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
it's also interesting in the context of like, being a TV writer, because that's very much a day job.
Yeah.
It's like, right? It's not like the same life as a painter or a comedian.
Or an Uber driver.
You have a 9-to-5.
What if an Uber driver was like, I had to give it all up?
I think it is oftentimes, but I think
I know there are like variations to that, and it's right. Not across the board that way. But it's like it's interesting to compare the two, like in a temporal sense, to be like, this is the same. This is like a 1-to-1 equivalency. Even doing stand up, like you may work the exact same number of hours as someone else, but it's just at a different time, which really fucks things up. The difference between that and having a 9-to-5 is so like vast, even if it's the same time commitment.
Yeah. Although I will say, I think Amy and Dan run their shows with a insanity that does.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure.
They absolutely. When they left Gilmore, they're like, we worked on this show every day for 6 years with no breaks or vacations.
Right.
It's like, of course you didn't do anything, you know, and they didn't have enough money, but.
They didn't have enough money. But also, they're just, that's their choice. It's not like, oh, I wish we could do some other way of living.
Yeah.
I don't think that's what they want.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Declan Howell wants anything else. I think he wants to be this drunk guy. And if he could find a way to be a drunk guy there where he wasn't abusive to everyone in his life so much that nobody could tolerate being around him, then maybe that would still be okay. But he can't. He's just got to be like, no, I'm too much of an artist. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know?
It is a thing you feel like you have to justify, though. I mean, I'm sure you
come
across that. Just like living that life where you don't really account for your other problems and like not having health insurance and not having like traditional ways of making money. Yeah. Like I understand like feeling like you have to justify it. So I won't like shit on him for that. But just like to say that you have to live that way it's a little much.
Right. But I'm just saying the pressure exists to the extent that we don't, again, it's like a thing we don't see and we don't acknowledge, like that it's like out there that, I mean, especially for me as a woman, like I would say it's really difficult to imagine my life being complete without having kids, even though I don't really know if I want kids.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, what the fuck? Like, why do, I mean, part of it is hormonal and part of it is like, you know, biology, but some of it is like, wait, is society. It's like playing a trick on you where you're like, you need these things, so check these boxes. Yeah. Otherwise, you won't have made it, really. Yeah. And it's like actually, and so a lot of people go to the other extreme where they're like, that's the other extreme where you're safe over there going like, just so nobody asks any questions, I'm a drunk.
Yeah.
You know, don't expect me to have a baby shower.
It can be a
get
out of jail free card of responsibility and citizenship on some level. But anyway,
for Midge, what does that all mean? Like, because I don't think it's going to be like And I guess, do you think the show is about that?
Do I think the show is about which part of it?
Do you think the show is about, like, is it? I liked this episode because it felt like it was like, let's acknowledge the fact that you're trying to do something here.
It feels like it's a real, okay, Catskills lady. It's Declan Howell taking her by both arms and shaking her, being like, what do you want?
And I like
this,
that.
Here, count the cost. I think this scene is as close to a perfect scene as you get on this show.
Yeah.
And the staging of it as a clear beginning, middle, and end. It's funny the way he undercuts his like dramatic high school theater kid monologue with, are you sure you won't sleep with me? That was my best line. And he can't acknowledge his own vulnerability. No one's going to see it. That's too bad. And then he says, Benjamin can take whatever penny he wants. So he's acknowledging like, he doesn't get it. He doesn't get what you and I get. You know?
Yeah, that was cool.
Even
that
if
was
it's
cool.
in subtext, like, this is the show shaking Midge. I think.
Yeah.
I think
and that's the other argument I have for Joel, is that Joel does get it.
Yeah. He extols her virtues at the Yom Kippur.
Benjamin's never going to be like, oh, this is so important to you, like doctoring is to me.
Yeah.
I think Joel gets it, but in a way.
Well, Joel can get it.
Yeah.
Right?
Joel can get it.
Okay, look. I think Joel gets it in a very superficial way.
I don't think so. I think he gets it.
I think he gets it in the sense
because
that.
Because he wanted it.
Well, yes.
And he couldn't do
it. I agree.
It.
But.
And now he
would
can
you,
get it.
Can I ask you this? Would you just hook up with any dude who had done stand up?
No.
Uh-oh.
What?
Exactly. I mean, would you be into, like, I don't
like
where
I'm not
this
saying
is
that
going.
I don't think
I like it, too.
Yeah, I just don't think, like, I don't think him having lived that life is, obviously, in comparison, because Midge comes at the whole painting situation from a standpoint of, like, someone who's not trying to impress him with her knowledge of art, which is why I thought they sort of bonded
but
on that. But I just don't think, like, the fact that Joel has sort of lived that life, I don't think that means anything.
But Joel is capable of bearing witness to Midge's experience fully because he has seen how great she is, and he knows what it's like to want what she wants. And so just because he can't express it and he doesn't have the magical potion of like talent that she has doesn't mean that he doesn't know what the pursuit is like and therefore recognize it in her and then see, like, I would say if Joel witnessed the conversation with Declan and Benjamin witnessed the conversation with Declan, Benjamin's reaction would be like, okay, Jim, to the camera, and Joel
full Halpert
and Joel would be like, wow, that's amazing, you get it, okay, so you guys, you know, you're going to have sex or whatever. Like, I don't know. People probably get jealous. But, like, you know, like, I just feel like Joel would be able to understand, at least from a observing he would be able to observe it and understand it and take it in a way that Benjamin wouldn't because of Joel knowing this art form in a way and respecting it. Like, and Joel, if we're looking for a love interest for Midge that's able to, like, be... I always come back to this. Did I talk about this in the first, like the writer of that book, Wild? What's her name? Cheryl Strayed.
Yeah.
Cheryl Strayed's husband.
Yeah, you leaned into that conversation.
Did I talk about that?
a little bit, but talk about
she
it
goes,
again.
Well, so her husband is a documentary filmmaker, and like people would ask when she got her book Wild and went like multi-platinum for books, whatever that is.
it won the box office book-wise.
It won the box office book award.
Gold medal for books.
Gold medal for books. So it was like a big deal, and she was going to get it optioned, and it was going to be a movie, and everybody was like, whoa, this is such a huge deal. And people were asking her husband, what do you feel? Like, you're a creator as well, and like, what is this like for you as the husband to be like, your wife's doing this huge thing now, you know? And he said, my reaction is that Cheryl is a truth teller, and my job is to bear witness to that. Like, he... Yeah. Completely undercut the question and was like, no, actually, you're asking like how I stay okay with myself while this person I'm attached to does this thing. But it's like, how about you think about it this way? Like, she's doing this crazy, amazing thing, and she's this artist, and I just get to be there.
Yeah.
And we don't have to make it okay or not okay. And I want Joel to have that experience because it's also very cool.
I think it would be great if he could have that experience.
I think that he's like almost there.
I think he is.
Thank you.
But do you, like, I just mean that in the sense of like someone, I don't believe that someone who has had the experience of trying to be an artist
mm-hmm.
is going to very easily transition into being the person watching.
I do because I was I did try to be an artist. Like, I went to art school.
But you are an artist. You are.
Yeah, but I did. Now I do comedy, and maybe Joel's art is buying buildings.
But, like, do you think you'd really be satisfied with that?
I think there's dignity and creativity and intellectualism and whatever.
I'm not saying there isn't.
In any career choice.
I'm not saying there isn't. I'm saying if you really want something.
Yeah.
And if you want that specific thing, I know for a fact
really
I couldn't,
to be a painter. And I realized I can't.
But do you think you could date a painter?
Yeah. He's great at being a painter.
I don't know that I could if I like
too much paint.
Yeah, if it's too messy.
You're saying if you quit comedy, you couldn't date a comedian.
I don't think I could. I don't think I could find it in me to do that.
There's no way if I quit comedy, I would date a comedian.
Yeah, and I think not.
But I don't think Joel wanted to be a comedian as much as he wanted to. Like, you think he wanted to be good at something?
I can see that.
Like, I don't think he wanted to be a comedian. He wanted to be, like, he liked comedy and he wanted to be good at something.
Yeah.
He wanted to find his place in the world.
I can definitely see that. But I don't.
And then he saw Midge and he's like, oh, no, I'm not that. So you do that now. And I'm going to go find my place.
I mean, that's weird that's the first comedian he would see and think, I can't do that.
Well, he didn't. He didn't. He gave up long before that at that point. He'd already given up, right?
Although that would make sense.
Or did he go up with the Gaslight again?
After when?
Oh, Jesus, these timelines.
It's one timeline on this show.
I can't. It's not an
Infinity War.
He's back and forth. Yeah. And
no, it's not complicated at all.
It's like the thing with Memento.
No, it's not Memento.
When Guy Pierce showed Memento.
I spelled it Memento.
He's just got Mort Saul's jokes tattooed on his body.
It's all worth it for that.
Yeah.
Although that would shake me. I think it would make sense if...
You'd be shooketh.
I would be shooketh if I were Joel and I saw my wife... Kill
my wife.
Kill at something that I was trying to do, because then instead of it being so out in the ether and it's only Bob Newhart and Bob Hope and these people, like, so far away from me, but it was so inaccessible. If someone I lived with and slept in the same bed with that was equal and capable of such greatness, but I wasn't.
And don't you think that maybe would take you a little while, and it maybe has taken Joel a while, and now he's on the precipice of being able to accept it?
You're really giving this guy a lot of credit.
Yeah.
I think you're giving this guy, and by virtue, men, a lot of credit that they don't deserve.
Don't believe I'm giving men a lot of credit.
I think by thinking Joel is capable of that,
I think this character that was written by a woman is capable.
Hey,
well,
I don't think any old Joe Schmo
so you think
out
women
there
are capable
the street.
Of this. So you think
yes,
women
I think
are capable?
Women are capable of writing this.
I don't think this man is capable.
I think women are capable of writing the blueprint for men.
And I ask Alice to do it every week for me. She won't.
I fax it over.
I said, how do I do my days? Should I bullet journal?
Hook up your fax machine and you'll get a bunch of faxes.
I can't deal with that technology.
Yeah, I'm an 80s girl.
And I'm a Luddite. let's talk about what?
I love it.
Yom Kippur, she finally tells the family. She reveals to the family that she's a stand-up comedian.
Do you have a clip? Or
I got clips.
You're saying it like you have a clip, but then you're not playing a clip, and you're just looking at us.
And now, what does that sound like? Let's find out by talking about it.
I think it will go a little something like this.
I'm a comedian.
Oh, no.
They did, by the way, in that scene, they did a very... Talking about the childlike propness of it. I guess the little kid that cast as Ethan can't act because they ADR'd all his stuff.
Yeah, they did.
In the strange way.
Oh, I liked that.
He's scary. Listen to this.
Yom Kippur is scary. I know, honey. Go to your room. Lock the door.
Yes, I will.
Is that my toy?
Not anymore.
I like
so
it.
So strange. The audio of that was
yeah,
weird.
It was really...
But anyway...
La, 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 la,
no, 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 no! She tells them, and Abe tries to play it cool, and he lies like he didn't know it before.
Which I thought was hilarious.
Very good, deducing that I am Abe, Miriam's father. Hello, person I've never met before. Nice to see you for the very first time.
I love that line, nice to see you for the very first time. Yeah. I died.
Great. I thought all this business was excellent.
Very good job deducing that I am Abe.
You, what? I'm shocked by all of this. Oh, it's wonderful.
Tony Shalhoub is a treasure.
It is.
He's
amazing.
Treasure. Oh, no. Beautiful. Did you guys like this scene? It was a long time coming. 17
episodes. I love
episodes.
This scene. This was like one of the most relatable moments in this very unrelatable family.
Well, and everything that everyone said was playing to their character.
Yeah.
Because sometimes they'll just flatten it out and it's like cacophony, a bunch of people talking, cacao. But it's like cacao. But Astrid was trying to be sweet and, you know,
And Astrid found a way to feel left out in it, which was amazing.
Oh, Astrid, when she announced she was pregnant, I was like, my heart sank a little bit for her.
Yeah.
I'm pregnant! I was just waiting until the right moment to tell you.
Congratulations.
You know what that felt like to
What's
me?
That?
You know when you're just like riffing with a group of comics and then you've been waiting so long to chime in and you like jump in and it just doesn't hit?
Yeah.
That happens to me on a weekly basis on mic.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Yeah, we love you.
We were kind of doing a thing over here.
I'm sorry, guys. You guys are so funny.
We love you, Kevin. You're a good guy, you know?
Susie, that's the worst compliment.
Isn't Kevin so nice?
He's so
Kevin
sweet.
Is so nice.
He's a sweetheart.
Oh, that's what like the
weird,
about dumb
weird dismissive way of talking about it. Like, he's a sweetheart.
I mean,
because you don't say they're talented or they're like, funny.
They're so
really
funny.
Talented. He's nice.
He's really talented at being nice.
He's so good.
I mean, like,
he's good at
even the talented thing. He found a way through. Oh boy, they've softened Susie, but in an honest, earned way. Because you see, she's looking for money. You get to see her her home life in a little like one act play from the 1940s.
Yeah,
and you meet her sister as played by Paladino alum.
Thank you.
Emily Burgle.
Who was she?
Francie at Chilton, seasons 3 and 4.
Oh my God.
Gilmore Girls.
Okay.
Yeah. The one kind of like conspiring against Rory with all the student council and the newspaper stuff
with Paris.
Or whatever that was. Yeah. She was going against Paris too. So Emily Burgle's like really matured into like this interesting. She pops up in these little guest spots.
I really liked her performance.
I loved her in this, and I think it's so fun to see an actor who's like, you know, not a star, not really a series regular on stuff and not in movies, but to see this woman who's like just done these parts and guest spots and roles and just continue to work and get better over time.
Yeah.
I thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
Because I thought the Francie stuff was
not great. No.
No, but she's great in this and the warmth.
Yeah, she was really good. Yeah.
Talking about fantasizing about ways to kill people.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of Susie's family stuff? I thought it was a nice way to round out the character.
Yeah.
Usually when we kind of branch out.
I mean, there's nothing else
like,
interesting about her, such as her sexuality and what it is.
I know.
Harp on the show a lot about why can't Susie just be gay?
Yeah. And I sort of thought her family was just like.
Including Ethan.
Just branches of her. Just like you.
Yeah.
Just sort of an explanation of why she is the way she is. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really feel like I got a lot of depth from that.
I think I got tenderness from it, though, because I felt like she interacted with her sister, Emily Burgle, in a way we haven't seen in a way with other people.
You have to admit it. Admit it right now.
He doesn't have to
don't
admit
do
anything.
This to
We're
admit it.
To
don't
opinion.
Do this to
We
me.
Shouldn't bully each other into having the right opinion, quote-unquote. We should just...
I don't know what I'm doing this podcast for,
it's a
then.
Pluralistic society. We have to be able to coexist with each other. What if in season 3, Yadoye is Susie's love interest? He's in the New York acting scene.
Hey, look.
Cast him.
I'm saying I want Doye to have more acting stuff, but I really don't want that because I want Susie to be gay. But could you play a woman? Then yes, I'd be down.
Ooh, complicated.
You know what? I think that would raise a lot of questions that I'm not prepared to answer.
Now, it's Mrs. Maisel. Could you also play white?
You know what? I've been asked to do it before. If I'm being real.
I would imagine.
By Amy and David.
I auditioned for the Mick.
Daniel, I mean.
Did you really?
Yeah.
And they asked you to play white?
They, I remember stopping myself in the audition and asking them, do you really want me to say kiss my white Polak ass? And they said, yeah, just try it. Just give it a shot.
Try it. Have a good time.
I love those auditions where it's like, yeah, no thought whatsoever is given to the racially the specific dialogue. Like,
is this my college theater troupe?
Oh my gosh.
I liked that scene. I thought it was good that they base it at the docks because we had that other scene with Susie.
Oh yeah, with the weird Goonie guys.
Yeah, with the weird Goonie guys being like, you're from the neighborhood. Mm. And then they had basically the same house.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they used the same location.
Yeah, that was cool.
She had this line.
She's got like 40,000 hats, but no car.
Yep.
Amy Sherman Palladino's bio on Tinder.
That's exactly what it is.
Is it?
Oh, yeah. She's a hat lady.
And not, oh, and know. Not a, and she does not drive.
I know. And, I watched the Emmys.
Oh, no. She drives. I've seen her car on the WB a lot.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I remember. Well, actually, it might have been
Daniels. Is it
like
one of those cars that looks like a hearse?
It would be. Right? If she could. She probably doesn't drive. You're right. She probably doesn't drive anymore.
I don't think she drives.
Her taste is so... I love thinking about this woman. As I will, apparently, for the rest of my life. Oh, my gosh. So then she goes and she slips out of Yom Kippur, does her set. You don't see the set. She talks to Susie afterwards. She's like, yeah, basically, I just reenacted Breakfast. So she's doing fresh material every time she goes
Like, what? How? Every time?
I know.
Every single time.
Although what's odd is at Breakfast, she does say, well, I have this one bit about Ethan getting bullied. And we have heard it before. Like, mama didn't raise no pussies. And we've heard that before on the show. So it's like a mix, I guess? Or like something notable happens?
Yeah. But, well, suspension of disbelief, I want it to be like, she's not going to talk about Breakfast. She's going to talk about maybe some material that she's had before that's about Breakfast that she's written and some other stuff from her act.
Yeah.
In front of a booker, she's not doing new material. But then again, this show all the time stomps all over what we would imagine to be the norms.
It's stream of consciousness stuff. And you know what? The Yom Kippur stuff, the back and forth with Kevin Pollak and Shirley being like, all right, tell a joke. You're funny. Tell a joke. That is very resonant with you tell people you're a comedian. It's just like,
maybe you should be a singer.
Yeah, you're fun. That's not so funny. It's not so good.
Yeah, and I love that people in that scene were like, what do you do with the children? Like, where are they when you're doing this?
Oh, the
try to stay with me.
Who stays with the children?
A lot of people.
Well, why haven't you ever called me?
So great. And you talk about your children that way, like on stage?
Oh, yeah, it's such a violation.
Like, or then they're like, oh, he was bullied? When? And the grandparents are worried about it. So I'm like, that's all totally believable to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene I thought was great.
That she Louis her kids. She's like, I hate them. They're little assholes, basically.
So Louis got it from her. So.
Yeah, that's what we're learning.
Yeah.
Is Zelda just Michelle Williams in 30 years? She looks like her.
Oh, wow.
Well, that was such a hard stopper. I'm sorry. That's who she looks like.
She does look a lot like Michelle Williams. Maybe.
I've been
maybe
playing a lot
Michelle
of Smash
Williams
Bros.
In 5 years.
I've been playing too much Smash Bros.
You're
to know who
Zelda.
Zelda
the princess.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand.
Too much Smash Bros. Eh?
Yeah. Too much.
Okay, Kevin. Okay. I played Kevin online recently, and I was so bad.
Oh, you sucked. So
I sucked so much, and Kevin was like. I was like, how often do you play this? And he was like, I've played it for years.
Oh, I have played it for 20 years.
Like really
and
good?
I didn't understand
What's that?
Are you like really good?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not like competitive.
What's your friend code?
My friend code? I'll give it to you after the show.
Yeah, give it to me.
Yeah.
I thought you said frame code and that was a special way of saying how good you were at Smash.
People do talk about frame rates a lot, which is intimidating.
What would Midge's final Smash move be in Smash Brothers? It would be a huge microphone.
She'd flash the person and have them get arrested.
She'd flash and white privilege would fill the screen and all the minority players would be pushed off of the stage.
She'd like run up to a microphone. Black woman gets pushed out of the way.
Or a microphone would have feedback and it would like.
Yeah. And then by the end of it, it does finally recenter and reframe the story. And I think it ends with the phrase that's as close as this show has to a catchphrase.
I want to be big. I want to be the biggest thing out there.
Tits up.
Tits up.
So Tits Up is basically their Oi with the Poodles already.
Yeah.
On Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Because it's what she says to her when she does her set at the Catskills.
Yeah. That's like their thing that they say to each other before they go
We away. Should say that to each other.
I think so.
I think that's a Frank Ocean lyric.
Tits Up?
That's a Frank Ocean lyric.
Is that truly it?
Tits Up. Silicon Valley new venture is Tits Up. Oh. How do I crop your new bitch out my vine?
Well, yeah. Amy seems like a big Frank Ocean stan.
Yeah, probably. That's probably where he got it from. Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised. So she wants to be big. Okay.
She wants to be big.
And so at the end of the episode, after it, we have this kind of like coming to Jesus about what it is that you want. We get this final moment of her being like, I want to be big. That's what I want.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So stop hanging out with Benjamin.
Yeah.
It's nothing to do with it, but I don't like him.
Let's get into some Twitter Q&A.
Tweet, tweet. Tweet.
Pardon.
Got a lot going. Pardon, Garcon. Sarah asks, are we supposed to feel bad for Joel during his drunk rant? I just never can. He says that it's the anniversary of his mistake, but wouldn't his mistake start with sleeping with Penny, which was before this? Or do you really think he doesn't consider that a mistake? Sarah doesn't like Joel.
Well, Sarah, more for me.
Okay, more for you.
Yeah, that's true. It was one of those fuzzy timeline things.
Yeah,
it's like the anniversary of their breakup, right?
You were mistaking Penny Penn's brains out a while before Yom Kippur, sir.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's not a mistake in the '50s.
True.
No, that's just
a virtue.
That's a textbook.
Avneet, who is a great question asker for this show, writes in and says, if you had to choose, would you rather watch Hal's nonsense bar speech, where he gets on top of the bar and kind of like rants, on a 10-hour loop, or the Gilmore Girls calling a year in the life across the universe scene for a 10-hour loop?
Oh, yeah, the speech.
I'd watch the speech.
I would watch the speech.
Mostly because he quotes Jabberwocky, and I think of the dance troupe from So You Think You Can Dance. And it's just very funny to me.
I'll never forget the look on Alice's face when we watched that scene together. It was pure and utter horror.
I couldn't believe what they were doing.
You couldn't believe it.
That was it's like a national television event, and this embarrassment. This utter embarrassment. Like, it was...
That was a real Santa Claus isn't real moment.
It was disgusting.
Laura asks, you know, kind of getting back to what Doye was saying before, is Joel really attractive or charismatic enough to have cultivated his own personal harem?
Nigga, no. No.
You don't think, but you just said that a guy in the 50s would be getting that much... play.
Exactly. And he is in the 50s. That's all.
That's all that it is. He's in the fact 50s. That it's the 50s.
Yeah.
2019 Joel would be at home swiping left and right.
And I really hope I'm not insulting this real person. I think I'm sure he looks like
Michael Zegan.
Zegan's an attractive man.
Yeah. I think it's just.
Yeah. You can see a lot of different. He cleans up better than.
Yeah. I think like.
The sounds. Let's try to get.
Oh, my Lord.
This is the dog.
This is the pup. One more.
It's coming.
Oh.
Oh, no.
Oh, man. That's Francisco, the small dog that's been in the room with us the whole time while recording this show.
This is how he breathes.
Oh, sweet boy. It reminds me of my chihuahua.
That's so sweet.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, boy.
Okay. Well, all right. I mean, yeah, probably it's the 50s. But and also, I don't know. I don't know what else I can say about Joel that I haven't said.
I know. We're getting to that point in the
podcast. We're getting to that point in the podcast.
Oh, boy. Well, I love this episode. I think it's great.
That's the only Twitter Q&A?
Yeah. There was one more Rachel said was the painting
of
just Fred of Rufus Sewell's cheekbones, which is the actor that plays Declan.
That'd be amazing if the painting was just of his own face.
Yeah, it pans
the most
around.
Beautiful thing I've ever seen.
I would love if the prop master totally pranked them on the day and it was just like a huge dick pic.
Yeah, just so...
of Daniel.
And they're just like, yeah, that'd be great.
It's like that painting, like the Norman Rockwell. He's just like in the frame. He's like painting his own dick.
Or something insane, like Simpsons hentai or something atrocious. Like, oh my god. And I want the viewers at home to imagine that when Brosnahan and Sewell are just fawning over it. Imagine they're looking at Marge and Homer.
No, Marge and Milhouse. 69ing.
He like painted a gif.
Oh, Lord. Well, Doye, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Of course.
What a great addition to the Maisel family.
Thank you very much for coming down here.
Of course.
Where can people find you? And what's your podcast that I forgot to plug at the beginning?
Oh, so my podcast is called Dark Tank. Mm-hmm. It's a show where I make white people pitch solutions to racism to a panel of black people.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I wish there was a dog on my podcast. That would be great.
This is incredible. What a gift to have this dog on mic for the show.
Did you say gif? What a gif?
Hey, either way.
You should trademark that because I'm not going to do it.
Did you say your Twitter handle where people can find you?
Oh, my Twitter handle. It's okay. I'm on Twitter at Professor Doye. Professor Doye. I host a YouTube channel about anime called Getting the Robot.
Hell yeah.
Which I, you know, it's fun. I speak very calmly on...
And Dory's going to drop a special episode next week where he assigns every Marvelous Mrs. Maisel character to their Dragon Ball Z counterpart.
Ooh, man.
It's coming soon. You can find Alice at Alice Wetterland.
On Twitter.
Listen to Treks and the City.
On Forever Dog.
Well, it's on the network Forever Dog, but you can listen to it anywhere.
You can.
Mm-hmm.
On the train, even.
And you can,
you can listen on the train.
You can listen with McCain.
You can listen with McCain.
Cindy.
Megan McCain.
Or Megan. Megan loves your podcast.
She really does. She's begging to be on it.
You can find me.
Don't know yet.
She's like obsessed with you.
Yeah, she is.
Oh my gosh. I'm at Kevin T. Porter. Come out to Maisel Gores Live March 23rd at the Dynasty Typewriter. Stand up and podcast show all in one, baby.
Don't be like Susie. Come on out to... Maisel Goy's Live.
Should put that on the poster.
It should.
Come to Dark Tank Live, too, at March 10th
at the
Comedy Store.
March 10th at the Comedy Store, Dark Tank Live. I'm going to be there. I don't know if I'm going to be on it because Doya hasn't asked me to be on it.
Whoa. Did I not ask you to be on it?
You did, but I am going to go even if I'm not on it because it's going to be amazing. You got to listen to Dark Tank. It's such a great show, but also a live version is going to be very fun. So see you there. Why did I say it that way?
Are you having an identity crisis on air?
I think so.
It was fitting.
This is fun for me.
Is that a good or a bad thing to say?
Oh, boy. Well, let's go out with the song that ends the episode. Opportunities, parentheses, Let's Make Lots of Money by Pet Shop Boys.
Oh, yeah.
Funny choice for the closing song. Hey, this was a fun, positive episode.
This
I had a blast.
Really good. I had a good time.
What a fun first-time guest. Come back for season 3 if you're in town.
Absolutely.
Hell yeah.
I'll be here.
Oh, he'll be in town.
I'll be in town.
This seems weird.
All right, we'll see you
next
week.
He's going to be rich and famous and very much in town.
Mm, there's going to be a lot
of
opportunities for Doye.
I'm what they call in and out of town.
You're like the burger.
Like the burger.
All right, we'll see you next week. And until then, keep on smashing.
No.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.